I'm with Robert Parker. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Serge.
So you're a focuser, a psychologist, and somebody who's very interested in philosophy and the process model. How did you get to where you are?
Well, I've always had a feel, even back in high school and probably earlier, for something of what it turned out that Gendlin is doing. When I hit graduate school in psychology, I could see very clearly that there were things wrong with the model that they were using, and what they were teaching me in graduate school felt wrong.
Was a behavioral?
Yeah, the behaviorism was big in those days, and still is. But now it's cognitive behaviorism.
Uh-huh.
I could tell that there was something wrong. I couldn't articulate it. I went in a lot of false directions in attempting to articulate it. Eventually discovered, in graduate school, discovered Merleau-Ponty and existential phenomenology.
So when you discovered existential phenomenology, was this within the context of courses given in the psychology graduate school, or
sure.
Was this, yeah, yeah?
Yeah, but there were, I took some courses in existential phenomenology,
mm-hmm.
And also I fell in with, you could say, a bad crowd. I fell in with existential mm-hmm. phenomenologists,
mm-hmm.
And so we talked and talked and talked, and I'd say I learned probably at least as much in the lunchroom as I did in the classroom.
Yeah, yeah.
But an interesting thing, most people don't know it, but we are all philosophers. Philosophy is about how we think. And most of us, when I came to existential phenomenology, I thought there was only one way to think, which is the way that I'd grown up.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were showing was that there was a completely different way to think, and so that you can't, if you have a different way to think, you can't talk about it in the old language. Francis Bacon, at the beginning of the Scientific Revolution, wrote a book in 1620 describing what it was like to be somebody on the cutting edge of science, developing a new way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And he was living in a world of medieval philosophers and Aristotelians and medieval science. The medievals had very good science, and they had they thought about a lot of things, figured a lot of things out, but they had it all framed in a way of everything is interrelated, it's an organic universe, things are what they are, because of their own innate qualities, which has to do with the order that of the universe. And Copernicus is coming with a view of a universe made of separate units. And the beginning of it was that the Earth goes around the Sun instead of the Sun going around the Earth. And what that did was it disrupted the whole organic orderliness of the medieval worldview.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was that the medieval people couldn't understand Copernicus. It wasn't that they disagreed with him. If you go back and you look at what they said, it was incomprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the old language, you couldn't say that the Earth goes around the Sun. It's a contradiction in terms. The Earth
right.
is the dense inert center of the universe, and it can't move. And if you're talking about it moving, you're talking nonsense.
So it's
a little bit like today.
Yeah.
If you talk about,
I want to stop a little bit. There's a lot you've been saying, so if you don't mind, maybe I just want to slow it down a little bit. And out of all these many strands, just maybe pick one where I'm hearing you going. And I think the point you make is that the medievals, it's not that they lacked science or observation, but they had a certain framework, a certain
That's right.
explanation of the world,
That's right.
from which it was simply impossible to understand the alternative explanation that Copernicus was giving.
That's right. It didn't make sense.
It just didn't make sense. And so, in a way, this point started as we were talking about philosophy. Yeah. And I think the...
I can wrap this up quickly.
Right.
I want to say that the idea of an earth that moves made as much sense to the medievals
mm-hmm.
as the idea of a mechanical body that develops consciousness makes to us today.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of a mechanical body, like the machine body of physiology, that kind of body, by definition, can't develop consciousness.
Right.
So then we get the mind-body problem, and we get scientific discussions, and scientific in quotes, I would say, discussions about how is it possible for us to have consciousness and free will when we've defined them out of existence right from the beginning by having this bodies that are made of inert matter, which by definition is not conscious. So
that's a very, very, very beautiful analogy.
When I was back in graduate school and I was learning existential phenomenology, I had a crash course because I was hanging out with fellow students who'd studied this for a lot longer than I had and understood it much better. And I eventually ended up renting a house with one of them, so we lived together. And so we would, and we were both really enjoyed arguing. So we would argue in the Platonic way of trying to find the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we would argue late into the night. We would get up in the morning. We would argue over breakfast. We would go to school. We'd argue in between classes. We'd argue during the lunch break. We'd argue after school. And we'd go for a long time on a single discussion. And this was a kind of immersion course in existential phenomenology, which nobody would be able to have. It was
right.
a tremendous gift. And what's interesting looking back on it is that with that immersion, with academic courses, with my friend Doug, who was incredibly patient and tolerant, and I had other friends also that were teaching me, it took me 4 years to grasp what they were saying.
Right. But what comes across as you say it is a sense that philosophy is not just and phenomenology and existential philosophy is not just a body of ideas, but is also the process of the discussion, and the two are intricately linked in your experience.
That's interesting. I have to think about that. Off the top, yeah, my experience of it is that what the discussion does is it makes what was implicit explicit.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened for me was implicit assumptions that I didn't know that I held because I held them implicitly.
Mm-hmm.
They came out in these discussions. And the initial experience for me was extremely frustrating because it felt to me like these my friends and the teachers were confronting me about things that were totally obvious, and obvious to the point of being trivial. Like, why are you asking me about this? And it took me about 4 years to grasp that what they were really doing was pointing me towards my own assumptions that I was having a very hard time examining.
Right, right.
And it's also interesting that if you go back and you read Francis Bacon, he wrote a book called The New Organon. And if you read book one of The New Organon, you'll find Francis Bacon describing exactly what I went through in graduate school.
And so to summarize it, what you went into graduate school thinking there's only one way of thinking, and that slow process was to discover that you could re-examine your assumptions and discover new ways of thinking.
That's right.
And Francis Bacon and philosophy, as he exemplified it, was seeing that the worldview of the Middle Ages, which thought it was the only way to view the world, could be re-examined into new paradigms, new ways of seeing
right.
the world.
Right. with tremendous results. We had the scientific revolution as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not academic. It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not academic. It has real-world implications in terms of science and the scientific progress as we described it.
Right.
But it has also this existential, you know, in an everyday sense, existential implication in terms of how one leads one's life and your own discovery in your own life that you could go beyond the limits you had in terms of thinking, your own thinking and the way you lead your life.
That's right. And there's an interesting thing that happens, that when you have only one watch, you think you always know what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you have two watches, you're not sure anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the being unsure is closer to the truth than the false being sure. So if you have two ways of thinking, then you know in your body that more ways of thinking are possible. They're more than just two. And there's a tremendous liberation that comes from having two ways of thinking.
So on a personal level, how do you experience that, or have you been experiencing that?
I find it it's huge. And it's transforming my life continuously. I don't know where the process is going to end, if it does, because it's not at the end yet. And it's also very hard to describe. I think partly because the only way to talk about it is with the old concepts. Like, I can talk about it in process model terms, but it doesn't make sense.
Well, maybe it makes sense to talk a little bit about the process model.
So, okay, that's good. I just wanted to say that, again, Francis Bacon, in 1620 wrote about this problem so well. He said that, you can't, put, the only way to describe the new ideas is with the old terms, and it's like putting new wine in old skins. It doesn't work.
Mm.
And then the arguments that you get into when you have what Thomas Kuhn would call a paradigm shift, so like different ways of thinking. Francis Bacon has this beautiful quote where the medieval people are saying that he's being irresponsible and he's, you know, not thinking logically and coherently. And he says, we refuse to submit to the judgment of a tribunal which is itself on trial. So it's about the difficulty of communicating across paradigms. But so your question was, what is the process model about?
Yeah.
And so what it's about is... implicitly, I think, is, well, actually, maybe even explicitly, there's a careful assessment of what Gene calls the unit model, which is the current received wisdom, and how it works, and it works beautifully in many areas, and also how it doesn't work.
So we have a contrast between, on the one hand, the unit model, and the other hand, the process model.
The process model. Gene is very strong about that the unit model is a very useful and important thing and not something that we want to throw away. Gene's in favor of having more ways of thinking, not less.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to say it because many... people at the beginning misunderstand him to think that he's trashing the unit model. He's definitely not doing that.
Right. So in a way, one of the differences between the unit model and the process model is that the process model is totally okay with not being the only model.
That's right. Yeah. I found that in back in my graduate school days that the new paradigm is usually more comfortable including the old paradigm than vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Like existential phenomenologists could think about the old thinking much more articulately than the old thinkers could think about existential phenomenology. Like, it took me 4 years to be able to think about it. So back to the process model. What he's doing is he's saying, well, we have this way of thinking today, which he calls the unit model, and he says what he means by that. And that it gets us into some very specific problems, and he outlines what they are. And then he says, well, what if we develop a way of thinking which is begins differently? So, for example, the unit model starts with the assumption of separate, unrelated things out there in the world, like or something, and then we understand the universe, including us, as made of increasingly complicated combinations of these units. And then it leads to things like the mind-body problem, because the units are made out of matter. Matter, by definition, excludes consciousness. So how do you rearrange pieces of matter in such a way that you generate consciousness? It's kind of like a shell game. And also values. Values are unscientific. You know, they can't be studied scientifically, and they have no, like, they're arbitrary. You know, anybody can come up with any values at all. All kinds of craziness. If you start off with the units and you try to work towards living things. So Gene says, well, why not do it the other way? Why don't we develop concepts from what it's like to be alive? Because after all, we're experts on that. We know a whole lot more about what it's like to be alive than what it's like to be a dead, inanimate unit. So we make concepts from what it's like to be alive, and then see if we can work towards developing concepts about units and about other things, including the unit model. And what we find is...
So I want to... Is it okay to just slow down a little bit?
Sure.
So just... what I'm hearing is, in the unit model, we try to create categories. And the categories are pretty rigid, and it's something, for instance, some like body, like what is matter, and another category, what is mind, what is thought, and then we find it very difficult to see how one thing could lead to another, so it further, you know, rigidifies the distinction between different categories.
Yeah. I think I want to... caution here that I don't think that rigidity is the problem. I'm not a philosopher, so I think that there might be, you know, like Gene might have something to say here. But my own sense is that if you have clear, precise concepts and you use them with precision, then you're going to be able to go someplace. If you use your concepts in a sloppy way, you don't go anywhere. And that's one of the differences between science and superstition. So if we're using concepts precisely and carefully and using them only appropriately for what they are, that could be called rigidity. And I think it's a good thing, because if you stay consistent with your concepts, you learn what the concepts can do. And I think in psychology, one of the things that's happened is people have used concepts in a sloppy way. And the result is that you don't learn anything. And you end up with a system that doesn't go anywhere. And in addition, you don't learn why it didn't go anywhere.
So it's not so much rigidity as the sense that the very definition of the concepts, for instance, when we define what body is in a mechanistic way, yields to a difficulty in accounting for the fact that thought and feelings arise from a mechanistic body.
That's right. That's right. And it's good that we run into that difficulty, because then we learn something. And then I think that, you know, you could say the process model, if you stay with those concepts and you use them carefully, somebody else might say that that's rigid, and I would say just fine. Let's find out.
Right, right. So in a way, the rigid creates, in a way, the trap that allows us to see where the problems are. And having problems is great because this is an opportunity to find ways to deal with them.
That's right. That's a scientific method, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's cool. But so what the process model does, though, it starts off with a different basis and begins growing from a completely different place. And it includes something like sentience right from the beginning. So the kind of the seed concept in the process model is occurring into implying.
So let's go in a little bit slower. Occurring into implying, yeah, what is that?
Okay, in order to, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
The process model begins with process, and it doesn't begin with things. So occurring into implying is no thing. It's a process.
Right, so in other words,
that we can feel. For example, when we breathe, we can feel in the breathing, number one, it's a process, right?
Right. But so when you say occurring, in a way, what it is you're defining things, say, occurring as opposed to being. So instead of talking about something that is an entity that is fixed, it's an essence, it's invariable, you're actually focusing on the aspect where whatever it is that we experience is a process.
That's right. And that we are a process.
Mm-hmm.
So that my lungs are a process. So the process of breathing has a concreteness about it. There's air, there's lungs, and the concreteness is organized in this process, and it's a living process that cares in quotes in some very basic way
mm-hmm.
about continuing,
mm-hmm.
so that. Like, if you pause right now and just feel yourself breathing, you can feel in each aspect, each bit of the breathing, each unit or
mm-hmm.
bit of breathing, you can feel that it cares about continuing. It's implying a next step.
Right, right. So as... In a way, as opposed to a being which doesn't evolve, by the very sense of talking about a process like breathing, a process in a way doesn't have an end. A process is about continuing.
It's about continuing, yeah, and it's also about evolving.
Evolving, not
yeah.
continuing in a static way, but
right.
what characterizes it is its flow, and that's what
that's
the
right.
implying is. Yeah.
Yeah, and the flow has this. This quality of implying, which is that the process wants or cares about continuing in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's much different from some rock or some
yeah.
unit that's just sitting out there and doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting is that using concepts like that and developing them in a thinking at the edge kind of a fashion, Gendlin has made a very, very articulate system of concepts which are able to think about, I would say brilliantly, about many, many different areas. For example, the process model is about 300 pages long, and it's about philosophy. It's about developing concepts, so it's not about any particular content. But he tosses off insights into different fields, just left and right, as
mm-hmm.
kind of illustrating the concepts as he develops. So what we have are whole new ways of thinking about evolution, for example.
Mm-hmm.
or about language and what is language and the origins of language, or about ethology, or about meditation, and just on and on and on.
And so it would be an illustration of how, as you shift from the worldview of unit model and of a certain way of looking at things, that perspectives of looking at things from the process perspective allows you to think of it in a different way.
It opens up whole new worlds, whole new ways of thinking, just like the scientific revolution did.
Mm-hmm.
The scientific revolution was an answer to a medieval worldview that was stuck, or you know, had run aground in certain areas, and you can see the fact that we're talking on the phone and making a recording of this and so on is you know, they couldn't have done that in 1500.
Mm-hmm.
So that many many things open up, and the same thing happens with the process model. Just when you have like a new way of thinking and you've been banging against old problems for a long enough time that you know them pretty well, just having this new perspective just opens up things.
Yeah, yeah. So it opens up things, you know, certainly philosophically. But how does it, for instance, open up things? You know, how does the fact of thinking in terms of the process model affect, for instance, your practice as a psychologist?
I understand things much differently. Before I knew the process model, I knew focusing as a kind of a procedure that I would do, and I would think of it in more or less in terms of steps. Now I think in terms of what's going on and what needs to happen. So I'm not sure I can describe the shift very well, but that's an attempt at it. So it feels I don't even think in terms of focusing.
Well, I want to.
What needs to happen?
Yeah, I think that's a very beautiful thing. That you know, I'm not sure I would be able to articulate what it is. But when you say that, instead of in terms of steps, thinking in terms of what needs to happen, there's kind of a gut level sense for me of resonating with you.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious about staying with that for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thinking in terms of what needs to happen.
So, I'm not sure where to go from there. I could go in the direction of saying up like another process model concept and show how that helps. Do you want to do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, one concept which helped me a lot was, re-recognizing. And without going into it, it's a way of thinking about the fact that our awareness is, in capital I, capital S, our awareness is an interaction with the world. So my awareness is not in my head. My awareness is an interaction with my environment. And that completely changes how I understand what's going on within myself or with somebody who's come to me for help.
So again, this is something I want to take a moment to say. In a way, just as you're defining it, there's a sense for me of in a way, the old definition, awareness, unit, and it would be awareness as a noun, is a thing, is something that's static. And when
states of consciousness.
Yeah. And when you say an interaction with the environment, interaction is, even though it's grammatically a noun, emotionally it's a verb. There's a sense of a process in it.
Process,
Right. And it's not something that's limited to what's happening inside of you, but okay. It is something that it's a process, it's a movement, it's something that is active, that's changing, and that's an interchange between, you know, say, me and the world.
That's right. Yeah. We're different with different people.
Mm-hmm.
I had an experience a few years ago where I had spent about 5 years living at a particular address in downtown Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, 20 years ago or something, maybe 30 years ago. But in any case, I had the opportunity to go back there, and I hadn't seen it for like 20, 30 years. And just standing on the street without even going into the apartment where I'd lived, just standing on the street and looking at the bricks and looking at the windows, I became the person that I was back then.
Mm.
I was thinking, like, still about, like, where I'm going to go and, you know, what my plans are in Montreal today and so on. But I could feel the thought patterns that belonged to myself 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
That my being is an interaction with my environment.
Well, so I feel moved as you say that. I had a very similar experience of revisiting the town where I grew up as a kid, and there was a very distinctive pattern of the sidewalks, the way they were covered, and looking down at the sidewalks, re-experiencing ways of thinking and being and of my childhood.
Oh yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's it. And if consciousness is inside of our heads, then, or we're going to use like a unit model way of trying to explain it, we've got some kind of, we have to think about, well, here's me with my system of thoughts and so on, and then there's a stimulus coming in, which then I react to, but how come the stimulus changes the whole process?
It's mm-hmm.
very, you know, it's hard to think about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also interesting to me as a psychologist that this way of thinking, of course, is very consistent with a lot of psychological research, which has been puzzling. With
mm-hmm.
A guy named J.J. Gibson has written about something about this back in the 50s. And everybody who reads J.J. Gibson, from what I can tell, you know that he's right. And yet nobody can make sense of it. It doesn't work in the unit model. Yeah. So it feels there's like a kind of, for me, a birth of kind of a new kind of being in the world, and at the same time I'm really excited by, you know, this is promising a second scientific revolution.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be able
mm-hmm.
to think about all kinds of things differently.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Bob, as we're coming to the end of the conversation, is there something that would feel right to add or to conclude with? Or
I'm not sure. One of the things which I'm a little hesitant about, but I'm going to take a plunge and say it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for some people, the process model can be a kind of spiritual exploration also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that many people aren't spiritual or don't want to be spiritual and don't like what the word spiritual means to them and so on. And so for them, you know, I don't want to frame it as spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to take it that way, it's very powerful, and it reminds me of the yoga of knowledge, like Jnana Yoga,
mm-hmm.
Where the continuous studying of the process model is, I find, transforming in some way. And so I think that's an important thing, which has to be said delicately, because it's something. It's just my impression.
Yeah, yeah. But I can hear it as when you talk about it as a path and a study, in a sense of a perspective that gives you a sense of communion with the world in a larger sense.
Yeah.
You know, that gives you that's a, in a way a process of interaction with the world and of making sense of it.
Yeah, that's actually a nice way of saying it. A sense of communion with the world, understanding the world as process also.
Mm-hmm.
The world is alive in a way also.
Yeah.
So communion with something much larger than oneself.
Yeah. So in a way that's a definition of your experience of spirituality.
Yeah. Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay. My pleasure.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.